Welcome to Greenbelt Festival Recorded Talks. This talk features Alistair McIntosh speaking at Greenbelt 2006. The topic is spiritual activism, transforming world and self.
As you can see, I've got hearing problems. It can be very embarrassing, especially in sort of church contexts, because I was giving a talk in a church some time ago about environmental issues. And as you know, and this is going to be part of my theme this evening, sometimes churches attract what you might call peculiar people. And this gentleman introduced himself as being a bigamist. And it was a bit difficult for me to see what the relevance was to my environmental theme, but I very delicately answered him, at which he replied loudly, "I said botanist, not bigamist." So there we go. I have to be a wee bit careful with the hearing side of things. I'm here tonight to talk about spiritual activism. The coming together of spirituality and activism, activism for social change, for environmental change, even for religious change, is something which has become increasingly important in my own work in recent years. It wasn't a connection that I immediately, naturally made. It was a connection that grew and was sometimes thrust upon me. And I'd like to share with you what that is about. Because we all know the various ways in which our world is in a mess, in which our own lives are often in a mess. And many of us, many of you, I'm quite sure, have had the experience of being on the edge of burnout, or possibly sellout, or simply copping out in your organizations. Because once you start giving yourself to community, there is so much hunger around, and yet often so much dysfunction around. Often forms of dysfunction that interacts with our own semi-conscious dysfunctionalities, that we get sucked into things in ways that can cause us to be badly burnt, can cause others to be burnt. And any of you involved in running any kind of church organization, never mind secular ones, know exactly what I mean. In fact, I'm losing count of how often I hear people working for what I like to call right-on organizations saying, at least in the secular world, they're honest about one thing. They're honest about money. And provided you're making money, you're doing all right. Whereas we who profess values have a very much more difficult task. And our motives and the motivations of those around us can be very much more clouded. We were talking about poetry a moment ago. And often when discussing the theme of what it means to be an activist, I use the work of an American feminist poet from Presbyterian and Jewish backgrounds, Adrienne Rich, and her book, Dream of a Common Language. And she has some lines there: "My heart is moved by all I cannot change. So much has been destroyed. We are living in a kind of dying time." When Jeremiah talks about a consequence of spiritual breakdown in his era, being that even the rivers are drying up and the plants and the animals are dying, he actually talks about extinctions, at least locally. So is the case for us too. Scientists estimate that between 10 and 100 species are becoming extinct every day. And what's so painful and what's so difficult to deal with is that we're only getting half the story if we blame the corporations or the military or whatever. Because the other half of that story is our own complicity, our own lifestyles. All of us, the way that I traveled to get here, for example, is complicit in that destruction of the planet. So you look into the mirror of the corporation, and yes, partly you will see the marketeers, the advertisers, and what have you, but uncomfortably, you will also see your own face looking back. Every time we buy a product for the cheapest price, as distinct from fair trade, we are part of that problem, and we all do it. I certainly do it. So my heart is moved by all I cannot change. So much has been destroyed. I have to call my lot, says Adrian Rich. I have to call my lot with those who, age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world. Now that's us, my friends. Our hearts are moved by all we cannot change, to such an extent that for many of us, the problem is compassion fatigue. And the challenge that for the Christian, or equally I would add the Hindu or the Muslim or the neo-pagan, anybody whose spirituality is founded in a sense of ultimate reality being love. For such as us, there can be no compassion fatigue. We have to face the suffering and engage. My heart is moved by all I cannot change. So much has been destroyed. I have to call my lot. Interesting, the biblical use of calling lots to appoint disciples. Zechariah, having drawn the lot that led to him being on the temple on the day that the angel told him about John the Baptist, etc. There's a kind of God-given randomness that moves us in this direction. I have to call my lot with those who, age after age, there is nothing new about this predicament we are in today. If you want to understand the roots of the Middle East crisis today, read Jeremiah again with a political eye to what is happening today. If you want to understand the ecological crisis today, read Ezekiel and see what he had to say about the ecological crisis. I have to call my lot with those who, age after age, perversely, we become the peculiar people. There's a 16th or 17th century usage of that word amongst English religious radicals like the Quaker tradition that I am attached to, where peculiar people in those days meant chosen people. But the double meaning is also very apt. Because to engage in this way, when it is not for material benefit, is a peculiar thing to do in the eyes of the world. Jeremiah said to God in what has been described as one of the most blasphemous parts of the Bible, Jeremiah 20, you find something similar in Jeremiah 15, he said, cursed be the day that I was born. If only I had died in my mother's womb. And he uses language that, according to the scholars, effectively accuses God of overpowering in the sense of raping him. The HarperCollins Study Bible describes that passage as the most blasphemous in the Bible, and it's coming from our old friend, Jeremiah, as I like to call him. My heart is moved by all I cannot change. So much has been destroyed. I have to call my lot with those who, age after age, perversely, are we prepared to embrace the perversity of what it means to march to a different tune for social and environmental justice in this world, who age after age perversely reconstitute the world? That's why we're in it, isn't it? Reconstitution of the world. And so we're talking here about community in the fullness of its meaning. We're talking about community, I would suggest, at three levels. At the level of community with the natural world. Community in the sense of the food we eat, the water we drink, the other species we share this planet with. We're talking then about social community. Community in membership one of another, as Paul put it. Very powerful expression. That's what community is. It's not just about libraries and schools and race tracks and what have you. Community at the deepest level is membership one of another. It is spirituality understood as profound interconnection. So here's you, here's me, here's the next person, like nails on these fingers. But at a deep level, we're all interconnected. And that deep level is a third level of community, spiritual community. In other words, friendship with God, interconnection with God, coming to know ultimately that I live, yet not I, but Christ lives within me. Or, because I refuse to believe that the Holy Spirit has only been active for the past 2,000 years in cultures of the Middle East and then amongst predominantly white cultures in the world, or equally the Hindu equivalent of that. Atman is Brahman. Individual soul is universal soul. We are all Buddha nature. We are all part of that body of humankind that is the Ummah, or community of Islam. I know that not all of you will agree with me that you can look on other faiths in this way. My central point, central reference point, is not a reference point of creedal belief. It is a question of connection of the heart with love. And as far as I'm concerned, if it is connecting with the heart with love, then that is a valid approach to discerning the meaning of life and the meaning of the spiritual. So reconstitution of the world, the creation of community, is the name of the game in our activism. And because community, if we are agreed, is fundamentally a spiritual sense of interconnection, a spiritual reality of interconnection, then we are talking about what another American feminist writer, a black writer, Audre Lorde in this case, in her famous essay, Uses of the Erotic, where she describes the erotic as being the passions of love in all its meaning. That's why my wife and I, Varenne and I, will be running a workshop tomorrow morning on sacred marriage. Because what we are talking about here, in terms of our commitment to this world, at the natural level, at the social level, at the spiritual level, and the way in which those are all intertwined, we're talking about dynamics of love, the meanings of love in all its passions, which are the same dynamics as we also find in intimate relationships. So this gets very exciting. It even includes sex, things like that, that we would tend not to understand in very conscious ways in our organizational dynamics. It gets very exciting because we're talking about really opening the heart when we understand spiritual activism, spiritually based, being active, being alive in this world in this way. Now, the problem is that once we start getting active in the world, we realize it is not a comfortable thing to do. It is a perverse thing to do, as we've already discussed. I could give you examples of my own use of spirituality and indeed explicit Christian theology in my work with land reform in Scotland on the island of Egg, or in the campaign that helped to save the mountain, Mount Runyavel, on the Isle of Harris from being turned into the biggest quarry in the world. But I'm not going to talk about those ones just today, because they're all in Soil and Soul in my book. And if you want to read up on that, and usually when I've spoken here before, a lot of you have already read that, so you know that story. What I'm going to do instead is I'm going to take an example, a very simple example of spiritual activism. And I'm just going to read you a passage from the autobiography called Experiments with Truth by Mahatma Gandhi, a Hindu who deeply loved Christianity. And this is Gandhi as a young man describing how he started off being an applied activist. And what I'd like you to notice here is how the core dynamic that qualifies Gandhi is simply his commitment to service. It wasn't his cleverness, because he didn't have much cleverness at this stage. It was simply his commitment to service. And this was what led him into greater things, as he here describes. Gandhiji writes, "I'd made up my mind to offer my services to the Congress office in order to gain some experience. Babu Bhupen Randaras," forgive me if there's any Indians here who can detect my useless pronunciation, "Babu Bhupen Randaras Basu and Sri Goshal were the secretaries. I went to Bhupen Bapu and offered my services. He looked at me and said, 'I have no work, but possibly Goshal Babu might have something to give you. Please go to him.' So I went to him. He scanned me and said with a smile, 'I can give you only clerical work. Will you do it?' 'Certainly,' I said. 'I am here to do anything that is not beyond my capacity.' 'That's the right spirit, young man,' he said. Addressing the volunteers who surrounded him, he added, 'Do you hear what this young man says?' Sri Goshal did not know me when he gave me the work. Only later did he inquire about my credentials. In a few days, I came to know the workings of the Congress. I met most of the leaders. I observed the movements of stalwarts like Gokhale and Suryendrath. I also noticed the huge waste of time there. I observed, too, with sorrow even then, the prominent place that the English language occupied in our affairs. There was little regard for economy of energy. More than one did the work of one, and many an important thing was no one's business at all. Critical as my mind was in observing these things, there was enough charity in me, and so I always thought that it might, after all, be impossible to do better in the circumstances, and that saved me from undervaluing my work." So lots of things that could be unpacked there. But what I find so interesting is the young Gandhi's perception, even before he had acquired many skills worth offering to the world, apart from his openness of heart, his recognition of how dysfunctional the organization was. And he's probably being very charitable in that description, because he was probably too young to fully diagnose the degree of dysfunctionality that you tend to get in organizations with a primary political aim, especially if they are not profoundly rooted in psycho-spiritual awareness. Note I use the expression psycho-spiritual to mean the continuum between the psychological and the spiritual. Ultimately, I would say the psychological is all spiritual. But out in the world there, it's often helpful to give people both handles so that if they're not comfortable with spirituality, they can at least hold on to the psychological, hence psycho-spiritual. Now, having been involved in non-governmental organizations for all my working life, for 30-odd years now, I've become profoundly aware and frustrated of the degree of dysfunctionality within them. I've already touched on this topic. And many of you will know in your churches, in your voluntary organizations and so on, just how profoundly painful that can be. Number of expressions come to mind. Rebels without a clue. People who think they can, but have no idea. And are primarily concerned with pushing themselves forward rather than with serving humbly, like Gandhi did. Why was it that the old man said to the other volunteers, look at this young guy. He's willing to do anything that's asked of him. The photocopying, cleaning the toilet. Gandhi considered cleaning the toilet to be the most sacred work of each day. The older guy did that, presumably because he had problems in getting those kinds of tasks done. Rebels without a clue. Another one, God gets what man rejects. Right-on organizations tend to be magnets for people who can't fit in with the mainstream way that the world does things. And the problem is that all too often, you end up wondering just how many people with difficulties can be carried. And sometimes you end up finding that you are one of those people with difficulties that others are carrying or perhaps have carried earlier on in your career. The tyranny of structurelessness. You see, we need to look at where we're at historically. We try to throw hierarchy out the window in many right-on organizations. Because in the aftermath of the Second World War and the analysis from the Frankfurt School, etc., of what had led to the Nazi mindset, what had led to the authoritarian or fascist mindset, we quite rightly recognized the dangers of hierarchical power and tried to replace it in the 60s and 70s with many countercultural types of organization. The problem is that those countercultural organizations developed different problems, which in their own ways were often just as tyrannical. Hence the expression, the tyranny of structurelessness. And I think one of the most important things emerging from the loose body of thinking now being referred to as spiritual activism is that we are exploring spirituality as a new way of doing management. I don't mean by that bringing managerial techniques into spiritual organizations, which is often a necessary, though often overdone or badly done process. I do mean recognizing, as George MacLeod of the Iona community once put it, that God is never served by inefficiency, and that we have a duty to do our best. But that if structureless organizations don't work, and if hierarchies are not what serves us either, where does it come from? Where does the constellating intelligence that holds together our collective effort come from? And I think that this is where certain spiritual traditions, we have it strongly in Quakerism, the Jesuits have it particularly well developed in the Ignatian area of thought, is so important. Because the answer to where it comes from is it comes from discernment. And that discernment is not about just thinking about an issue. Spiritual discernment is not just about doing clever tricks in your head. Spiritual discernment is coming out of a very deep psychology of what it means to be a human being. So if we are profoundly interconnected at this God level, I live yet not I, but Christ lives within me, we become, as Peter puts it, participants in the divine nature. If that mystical understanding of what a human being is what we are about at the deepest level, what is going on at these more superficial levels? Indeed, what is the makeup of these more superficial levels? Well, in my own work, I use very heavily the structure of the human psyche, the structure of a human being, in its full totality, including the environment and others around it, that the Swiss psychotherapist Carl Jung put forward. And let me simplify that very greatly. And there's always a danger with these psychological models, because if you get too rigid in your thinking about them and you forget that they are just models, you can misunderstand what a human being is. So let me emphasize here that I'm presenting a model, and it's very, very simplified. If you imagine a triangle with three layers, right on the top is a little light. That is your ego, that little light. Your ego is the conscious you. The ego is me as Alistair McIntosh, married to Viren Nicholas, writing books, maybe hoping to sell a few, but I better not let on about that too much. I'll push that one out of the way. I'll submerge that one a little bit. Okay? That, you know, I hope I might sell a few books while I'm here. Because that's not very comfortable to think about. My ego doesn't feel proud with that. So we've got the ego and the area of consciousness. Right now, you are what is in my field of consciousness. At the top of that spectrum, the fingernail level of that spectrum. But underneath it is another level, the second layer in our structure, which we call the personal unconscious. Now, the personal unconscious is all the parts of me or you, specific to me or you, but about which I am not fully conscious. Things that happened in early childhood. Things that I don't really want to think about. Like what I was just talking about. The bits of me that are selfish. The bits of me that are worried about money, even though I'm talking about spiritual issues. And so, you know, it would be nicer not to think about that. The bits of me that is aware that I said something to my wife this afternoon that was a bit of a hardening of the heart. Ironically, when we were discussing how we're going to run our workshop on spiritual marriage. Now, this is what we call a shadow. So the shadow is the alter ego. The ego is all the bits of me that I like and I've got in consciousness and so on. The shadow is all the bits of me which I've kind of pushed down into the basement. But also, and this is hugely important, all the bits of me that are undeveloped. Because when my wife and I talked through the issue that was causing some friction between us, we actually broke through to a deeper level of understanding of what it was we were going to be trying to do. Thus, Jung says, 90% of the shadow is gold. And psychological growth comes about through recognizing, first of all, that we've all got a shadow. And that shadow can be pretty ugly. It includes the potential rapist in Alistair McIntosh, the potential murderer in him, the potential swindler, all the rest of it. It includes all of that, but it also includes all the human potential that has not yet grown into the fullness of being. So developing a relationship between ego and shadow is hugely important. Now, why is this relevant to spiritual activism? It's relevant because if we let our egos act as if we are unaware of the potential of our own shadow, indeed the reality of our own shadow, lurking down in that personal unconsciousness, then a very unpleasant thing happens that accounts for most of our organizational dysfunction. We project out or cathect out onto others that which is blocked in ourselves. We see in others that which we don't like or which we fear in others. And we are unable to help others deal with their shit, if you forgive me using that word, but it is hugely appropriate in the circumstances. Therefore, I appeal to you to allow me to use it as a theological term. We are unable to help them to deal with their shit because we haven't dealt with our own shit. You see, what is this ego, to start with, of which the shadow is the alter ego? The ego is itself a very fragile entity. That's why it's so full of pride. That's why it's always out to build itself. That's why it's always not really prepared to trust to giving us this day our daily bread. But it wants a job for life and a pension to end it with. The ego is quite a fragile entity. It's a very important entity because it is our interface with the world. It is what being incarnate in this world means. So I'm not suggesting a Buddhist or certain types of Buddhist options that the ego is something we should destroy. The ego is hugely important. It is hugely important that I am able to come here and represent myself as Alistair McIntosh with all the ego-related attachments of what that means, and you know something of what that is about in terms of hopefully it being something that can provide something that will nourish you. That is just one example. And incidentally, that front end of the ego, that professional face, if you like, is what's called the persona, the leading edge of the ego, the mask. That even I know, if I think of myself only as being a lecturer to such a nice audience as this, and I build my self-identity all around that, even I know I'm going to chop up pretty big time with that. So you've got the persona at the front edge of the ego, and then you've got the rest of who you are around that. So the ego is formed through your life experience from early childhood, but often very damaged in its formation in early childhood. The whole point of a good child upbringing, a good child rearing, is to develop a sound ego structure. And you know, it's sometimes said you can't lose your ego until you've found it in the first place. So developing that ego is hugely important, but if we only believe in the ego and we forget that we've also got this shadow side to ourselves, then we become narcissistic. What is a narcissist? But a narcissist, technically speaking, is not somebody who's in love with themselves. That's a rather narrow definition. A narcissist is somebody who constructs a sense of their self, constructs a sense of how they would like their self to be, and puts it out there, says, this is what I am, and believes that, and is then hugely vulnerable to anything that challenges that. Will backlash, will shadow strike anybody who challenges that sense of who they were. So if we're talking about forms of activism that are about being peculiar people, that are about, I cast my lot age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, that is not something you can do in a sustained way from an ego level. You've got to do that with an awareness of your shadow self integrated in. And you've got to understand that in doing that, not everybody will have the same level of psycho-spiritual literacy. Not everybody will have done as much work on themselves as you hopefully might have done or will start doing. And therefore, you're going to be moving around in a world where some people are just egos on sticks and others are building a deeper foundation to what it means. But we haven't seen the whole story yet, because there's three levels in this very simplified model that I'm talking about. And the third level is what Jung called the collective unconscious. So, you know, if you like, here's our ego level, here's our personal and conscious level, and just around this level here is an area where there is a shared basis of interconnection between us. And this is the level at which the soul resides, psychologically speaking, or what Jung called the self, with a capital S, in order to avoid freaking out those who wanted to make out that psychology is a scientific discipline. So this is the level of the self or the soul. And of course, this is what is crucial in our activist work, because the question then comes about of identity. Who are you? Not least, who the hell do you think you are to be challenging me in my corporation, or my war, or my effort to destroy your local piece of woodland, or whatever? Who do you think you are? Often the question posed to us as activists. So we need this understanding, this psycho-spiritual understanding, in order to strengthen ourselves in who we actually are. Because if we're only doing it from an ego level, we're going to trip up big time. Our activism is just going to be a big ego trip. And we see far too much of that in many of our organizations. Narcissistic individuals playing out their projected sense of who they want themselves to be through the organization, and unable to look at their own darker sides. But equally, if we only do the psychological thing, and we do our Freudian psychotherapy or whatever school we want to go to, our bit of counseling, in order to get in touch with our shadow side and our personal unconscious, spiritually speaking, that is not enough either. And that is where the activism is only going to be sustainable in the long term. We're only going to avoid burning out or selling out or copping out in the long term if we connect it down at the core roots of where human life energy comes from. And this is the level of the soul. So our activism has got to be soul work. Now, that's probably pretty obvious to you, the way I'm saying it just now. And forgive me if I appear to be trying to teach my mother to suck eggs, or whatever the expression is. Never quite understand why one's mother would want to suck eggs, but there we go. And yet, Jesus recognized that that level of threat, that level of threat is jumping ahead a bit too much. The recognition that soul level, spiritual power, is what we are ultimately dealing with, is as dangerous to us as any other form of power. What were the three temptations on the mountain? If we take the ordering given in Luke's gospel, the first temptation was to turn stones into bread. And I would suggest to you, and we can look at these things in many different ways, as you're well aware, but I would suggest to you that in terms of the dynamics of activist engagement and understandings of power in this world, turning stones into bread can metaphorically be seen as being short-circuiting the laws of nature. Dostoevsky says so much in his Grand Inquisitor's exegesis of that passage, where the Grand Inquisitor says, imagine the power you would have over humankind if you were the one who could turn those stones into bread. And in many respects, forms of agriculture that are not in right relationship with the planet, but which are short-circuiting nature's processes, are doing precisely that. They are turning stone into bread. And that was the first temptation of Christ, the temptation to abuse the power of nature. The second temptation of Christ is what I like to call, because of my work with land reform, the temptation of landlordism. If you will only bow down before me, says the devil. What a useful figure this devil is. If you will only bow down before me, I will give you all these kingdoms. I will make you a great landlord or a great king. In other words, the second temptation of Christ is to abuse social power. First temptation, natural power. Second temptation, social power. The third temptation is sometimes rather more difficult to grasp, but hugely important in the context of what I've just been saying. Put God to the test, says the devil. Climb up to a high place and jump off, and God will send the angels to rescue you. The third temptation of Christ, in other words, is the temptation to abuse spiritual power. And in my opinion, spiritual abuse, never mind your sexual abuse or your abuse of resources or whatever, spiritual abuse is the deepest area of growth that the church and like organizations needs to expand awareness of. Because if we are not aware of the dangers of spiritual abuse, but we start talking spiritual activism, we become the cult. What is a cult? A cult is an organization where spiritual power is appropriated and used to inflate ego. Instead of operating from the God center and being discerned, being listened to, that's all discernment is. Discernment is a deep process of listening, like starting each day and saying, what does life ask of me today? God, what do you ask of me today? Jesus Christ, what do you ask of me today? However you would wish to understand it. That's discernment. No big song and dance about it. In fact, I think the next speaker in here, a brother from Tezi, will probably be speaking along something like those lines. So, if you don't connect at that level of profound discernment, individually and collectively, then spiritual power inflates the ego, and you become the cult. You start usurping the place of God. You might say, well, why on earth does God let that happen? Surely you cannot abuse spiritual power. Well, Jesus tells us that the rain, the sunshine, will fall on good and bad alike. And I suspect we have to face the reality that spiritual power, the power of love, can be abused and often is abused. And much of the difficulty in our right-on organizations and our churches is that we have not faced up to that, not least because those who are holding power and structuring power have very often done very little psycho-spiritual work on themselves. And I would just love to see more growth in awareness. It's already starting to happen in some quarters, thanks to the whole sexual abuse dynamic. It has forced the churches to start waking up, but it needs to go far, far deeper. And it would be improper for me to even say more about that here just now, because I haven't thought it through deep enough in a church context. But I leave that one with you. We end up seeing that, like the young Gandhi, we may have many skills. We may have many forms of title. We may have many forms of natural, social, and spiritual power. But at the end of the day, like the young Gandhi, we must be profoundly humble. We must be deeply psychologically honest with one another in how we hold it. Otherwise, we screw up and we stop growing. What are we left with? I'll leave you with a story that Dostoevsky tells in The Brothers Karamazov, which apparently is an old Russian folk story. There was once, he says, a wicked old woman who died and went over to the other side. And she went before St. Peter, who looked in the book and shook his head and said, I am sorry. You've been a very wicked old woman indeed. We can't let you in upstairs here. and the demons appeared and dragged her downstairs and threw her into the sulfurous lake of fire with all the other lost souls. My goodness, how I love these fundamentalist metaphors. They're so psychologically helpful. We would have to invent them if they didn't already exist. Anyhow, the old woman's guardian angel is watching all of this happening. And having been looking after the old woman all her life, the guardian angel can't help feeling some sadness at this eternal fate. And so the guardian angel goes back upstairs and has a word with St. Peter and says, look, do you think you can let me in to see the old man? I'd just like to argue the case a bit more. So the angel goes in and speaks to God and says, you know, is she really that bad? Are you sure you can't justify letting her in up here? And God says, well, tell me, pulling on his beard, tell me, did she ever do anything good in her life? And the angel thinks for a long time and says, yes, yes. There was one time that a beggar woman was passing by when she was in her garden and appealed for some food. And the old woman pulled a spring onion from her garden and gave it to the beggar woman. So God turned round and rummaged deep into the recesses of the great cosmic cupboard and said, oh, yes, yes, you're quite right. Here it is. I have that very spring onion right here. I'll tell you what, says God to the guardian angel. You take the spring onion down to the lake of fire, and if you can pull her out with it, I'll change my mind and I'll let her in up here. So the angel goes off downstairs, and there's all the lost souls swimming about in the lake of fire. And the angel holds out the spring onion, and the old woman catches hold of it. And very gently, the angel starts drawing her out to her salvation. And just as she's almost liberated, the other lost souls all see what is happening. And they start clutching onto her dress, grabbing onto her legs. And she's afraid her onion is going to break. And she shouts, get off! Get off! It's my spring onion! And at that moment, it broke. And she fell back into the lake. And so I leave you, my friends. When it comes to the psycho-spiritual understanding of spiritual activism, we may feel profoundly uncomfortable because we will realize how complicit and compromised each one of us actually is. But I put it to you that perhaps each one of us has at least a spring onion. And if we can resist saying, it's my spring onion, if we can share it in the fullness of spiritual community, perhaps that's what will see us through. Thank you very much.
We've got time for 5 minutes of questions. I think we've got a mic which might move around. Yes?
Good evening. Kieran from the Catholic Worker from Dublin. My eventual question is going to be about this war and how disengaged people are generally. But your whole emphasis there on perversion and peculiarity actually explained something to me from 15 years ago. I was being released from Louisiana Penitentiary after serving a year for disarming a B-52 bomber. And they charged me as I left with overstaying a visa and being guilty of a crime of moral turpitude, a word I did not know what meant, and the agent didn't either, and we looked up a dictionary. But 4 weeks ago, some good news, that five of us were found not guilty of $2.5 million criminal damage to US Navy warplane. And just in bouncing off your main message there, I think it was exceptional for both us five and the 12 jury, because we had disarmed the plane at Shannon Airport, the civilian airport, where most US troops go through to the illegal invasion of Iraq, where most have died have gone through. And we did this on February back in 2003, when millions of people marched. And we were kind of trapped in a process for 3.5 years because we were on bail, awaiting trial. And we went through three trials. The first two collapsed. And whether we liked it or not, we had to be engaged with this war, which the Iraqi people have imposed on, these young Americans are going through Shannon to, but which most people who marched back then are disengaged with. And these 12 jurors came from a disengaged society which is very little about the nature of this war from the Irish media, and were stuck and engaged for 2 weeks, where they heard from Kathy Kelly, who was under the bombing in Baghdad, where they heard from Jimmy Massey, whose unit killed over 30 people at checkpoints who were unarmed. And that was exceptional for both of us, that we were stuck, whether we liked it or not, with this war. And I wonder, as we're in spitting distance of British Central Command intelligence here, how do you reflect on the disengagement of the general population with this war that's both escalating and expanding? Thank you.
I mean, it's a question that vexes me greatly. And the reason I offered to stand in for my good friend Walter Wink and my mentor Walter Wink, I mean mentor in the sense of reading his books, I've only met him a couple of times, but very profound meetings with him, is precisely that I want to speak to that issue on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, where Walter's title was Nonviolence for the Violent. And I'd like to speak about the work I've done over the past 9 years at the Military Staff College in Shrivenham on the Advanced Command and Staff course, speaking to 400 senior officers at a time on this issue. And what I do with the military, just in synopsis of what I'll be saying on Sunday afternoon, what I do with them is I attempt to wake them up spiritually. Now, many of the military are already religious people in a conventional church-type sense. Many of them are also very deep people, certainly at officer level, because these days, most of them have seen actual fighting. It's not like Cold War era. They've seen actual fighting. And they are confronted with the moral questions raised that most of us avoid. And what I do when I go there is I try to wake them up to the fact that the issues we are dealing with are very profound spiritual questions about which there are no easy answers. It is just as difficult for doing what you have described and the kind of actions that many of us in this room, I'm sure, have taken part in various ways, including ones technically illegal. It is just as difficult to do that as it is for conscientious military people to go out and do what they are doing in Afghanistan and Iraq, where I can tell you a majority of them, including some of the most senior generals in this land, do not agree with what our government is making them do. Having been one of the million people who marched against that war and have engaged in many other forms of activism against it, I have no more answer to your question than you have yourself. We failed to stop it. But what we must do is use the suffering of what is happening as an opportunity to raise spiritual awareness. And not least, I would suggest, to express spiritual humility towards our Muslim brothers and sisters, and bend over backwards to understand their faith approach from the inside out, and to confess the failings of our own approach, where, for example, Sir Stephen Runciman, the greatest chronicler of the Crusades, describes the Crusades as having been a sin against the Holy Spirit, and describes Islamic extremism as having been a reaction to early Christian extremism.
Thank you, Alistair. We've actually run out of time. Both Alistair's books, Soil and Soul, and the poetry collection Love and Revolution, are in the bookshop. And as you know, he's around during the weekend. Please give him a round of applause. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Greenbelt Festival Recorded Talks.